What's up, Oos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me, about to get them, all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. Last week, we had on Beth, who hosted season 4 of the Bone Valley podcast. It was an incredibly interesting case and season of the podcast. Just last week, season 5 of Bone Valley, titled The Devil's Quarry, just came to its conclusion. Its 8th episode aired. And today, I have the host of that series, Mr. Paul Solotaroff, on with me. And this is another one, Paul. When I told Beth, and she was the first time in a long time. Usually when I am interviewing somebody, I'll listen to a couple of episodes, get a feel for it, do some research. Season 4, I couldn't stop. I binged the entire 8 episodes before I had her on. Monday, I got on to listen to some of season 5, and I had to binge the entirety of season 5 before you got on. The case is fascinating. Your reporting is amazing. So just incredible work. Thanks so much for taking time to talk to me.
I'm honored to do so, and I'm so glad that I didn't darken your Sunday.
Right. Yeah. You know, speaking of which, that as you guys are hearing Paul's voice, I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and the first thing I thought of about 5 minutes into season 5 is, why is this guy not narrating spooky season horror-style audiobooks? Has this ever come up before?
I've been hearing a bit of it lately, and I guess you can probably credit my old man, who told me 2 things when I was young. 1, my face would never be my fortune. And 2, I had a fabulous face for audio. So it's taken me 40 years, but here I am. And honestly, it has been such a joy and such a privilege to do what I do in print now, through the magic of podcasting, to lend both my writing voice and my speaking voice to the kinds of stories that keep me up till 3 in the morning with righteous indignation. And this, of all the stories I've written, Bob, of all the bombshells I've broken, whether it's the NFL concussion scandal, the Aaron Hernandez horror show, I got the rapper Meek Mill out of prison. I've walked multiple men off death row, having proven their innocence. I wrote a story that helped exonerate 42,000 low-level drug defendants against the corruption of the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab. All of those are now Netflix series or Amazon series, HBO series. This is the one that has haunted me since the day I set foot in Putnam County, New York.
The case and the story are horrific. And as the story unfolds, I just found myself, and you know, I've spent 11 years investigating wrongful conviction cases. And this is, I mean, it's shocking. It's shocking the level of both corruption and apathy in Putnam County to have allowed this to go on. Before we get into the case real quick, I know you're a longtime award-winning journalist from Rolling Stones. Is this your first venture into audio production? Has it always been print writing?
It is, yeah. So much so that, you know, Rolling Stone offered to pay me to do the audio read of my own stories. And I said, I'll do it if someone can then come in and dupe my voice, because I'm sure I will suck at it. I will pat myself on the back for one thing. I was right. When I started doing this, I sucked. I was such a self-conscious, melodramatic reader, and I couldn't figure out a way not to read my own writing in a stilted and kind of over-amplified way. And finally, I realized if I just talk like myself, I'd probably be able to reach an audience and engage them in the conversation that my writing has always been anyway. I write very differently than most journalists, and I write with different intentions. I write in such a fashion. I've been trained as a novelist and as a playwright. That was my training as a journalist. I write to put my reader inside my skin. They're inside my skin. I then sneakily transport them into the skin of the people who have been victimized. The people whose suffering is almost biblical, but who can be rescued. And to that end, I have only written with one intention, and that is not to report the facts on the ground as I find them, but to change the facts on the ground as I found them, to get justice for those deprived it, to get the truth for the families denied it, and to avenge them on the corrupt cops, the corrupt district attorneys, the corrupt state prosecutors who have committed this monstrous lie. And in so doing, not only robbed those communities and those families of the truth, they have, in almost every case I report, allowed a predator to go on hunting. And that's right. What I got into this business to put a stop to. You know, so I'm a kid who was bullied as a child. I'm a guy who was bullied as a kid until I reinvented myself in the gym and became a giant steroid monster and male stripper in my early 20s. And it was at that point, right around that point, that I realized that I was put on earth to bully the bullies. And journalism,
I love that,
puts me in the ring with shitheads, typically those in power. And I get to annihilate them on behalf of the people they've brutalized, but also for the rest of us. And that's why they sent me all those awards, because I go get the motherfuckers.
I love that. And that very genuine attitude comes through. That I think my favorite part of the series is, I think it might have been at the close of the seventh episode or within the eighth, when, spoiler, you know, Anthony gets out and kind of reaches the end of what he can do. And it's like you just step in and say, but, you know, I'm taking it from here. And it just gave me chills when you said that, when you're like, you know, I'm going to, and then we start to hear you start to do that.
Yeah.
To me, it was so refreshing to hear that, because we, at the end of the series, we get to hear you talking to Howard Gombert on the phone. And prior to that, you know, we're hearing your reporting, you're reading what you wrote and the narration, and you're wondering as a listener, is this a character that we're hearing come through here? And then at the end, we get to hear you in a real life phone conversation with this guy. And it's like, oh, shit, no, that's this. Everything we heard up till now is Paul, because here I'm hearing Paul have a conversation and he's a motherfucker. He's a motherfucker. He's doing his narrative and he's a motherfucker to Howard Gombert when he's talking to him on the phone. And I love it.
Let's acquaint your listeners with who Howard Gombert is. Howard Gombert is a ticking time bomb. Howard Gombert roamed freely for 20 years in westernmost Connecticut, right on the border of New York State, and then moved 15 miles over to Putnam County in New York State. For listeners not acquainted with the geography of the tri-state area, Putnam County in particular the town of Carmel, is exactly an hour from New York City, either by commuter rail from Grand Central or going up 684 if you're driving. And it's close enough so that the white flight of the 70s, when New York, like so many cities in America, was in the throes of enormous turmoil. There was all this federal funding to essentially wipe out blight in the outer boroughs, the Bronx, Queens. And what happened was there's enormous construction projects of public housing in places that had been entrenched working white class families. And many of those working white class families fled. And where a lot of them fled to was Putnam County, because again, you could commute to the city if you were a New York City cop, fireman, sanitation worker, Con Ed worker. And those blue-collar families moved en masse to Putnam County, particularly to a town like Carmel, where for $35,000, Bob, you could buy a Sears Roebuck kit home, brand new, and drop it on the banks of Lake Carmel or Lake Glenida and live like a prince. The problem is, when you build a $35,000 house on the banks of a pristine lake, you will probably have installed a septic system worth $1,000 new.
Right.
Almost immediately upon occupying these three-bedroom, you know, ranches, those families began pouring their gray water through these cheap septic systems into the groundwater directly into these gorgeous lakes. What is the upshot? 20 years later, in the 1990s, they had to start bringing in a guy in an amphibious lawnmower to mow the fucking lakes. Why?
Jesus.
Because when you send all of that wastewater into clean water, the nitrogen you're introducing causes huge bacteria spores, E. coli, to grow and mass produce. And so during the summers, you would see these enormous weeds rise like redwoods from the bottom of these fairly shallow man-made lakes, which, by the way, are part of the reservoir system for New York City. The drinking water from New York City comes in part from these incredibly toxic lakes. And The kids I talked to are now middle-aged men and women told me they'd go swimming because no one knew better. And they'd come down with serious ear infections, lung infections, stomach problems. And it was chronic. And it was just part of the cost of being a kid in Carmel, New York. So that's the region we're talking about. Close enough to New York that you could easily commute, but far enough away that once you were in that $35,000 Sears home, you could pretend that New York and its diversity and the melting pot of cultures was an evil that you never had to contend with. Mm-hmm. What you get out of that is a certain kind of mass think, a group think that is furiously pro-cop and wildly uninformed about how cops operate when there's nobody looking over their shoulder, no civilian review board, no state inspector general, nothing. The sheriff of Putnam County has a long-standing tradition of the most obvious and transparent corruption. And in that era, the era in which my series is set, a number of his senior detectives operated as his leg breakers, as the guys he sent around to coerce campaign funds from, businesses, wealthy individuals. And this has been written about extensively. Point being, you have all these cops living in this town of about 30, 35,000, but none of them are cops there. They're cops in New York City. The cops hired were not trained as cops, didn't take tests to become detectives. You had this extraordinary deficit of skilled labor when it came to law enforcement. And they got away with it for so long because there was very little violent crime. So when these two girls in The Devil's Quarry in season 1 and 7 2 go missing, and then one of them turns up dead, buried in a shallow grave in the woods just outside Carmel, cops who were essentially a clown car act were appointed to track her killer. And instead of actually doing an evidence-based professional investigation, they chose two kids out of a hat, two kids with no history of violence, with no serious crimes, sexual or otherwise, and framed them for the murder of the first abducted girl, Josette Gray. And that's where we enter the series.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
I like having the context of how, you know, you have all these untrained police officers, because that was one of the things that is so stunning when you listen to the series. Is what was the lead detective's name?
Pat Castaldo.
Castaldo, yeah.
6'2", 6'3", self-described ninja, fat, brawny, led with his fists and his feet, was finally forced off the squad in 2014, perhaps. 2013, 2014, when he was caught on camera beating the living shit out of a padlocked 130-pound detainee. He happened to do this in the courthouse, the brand new courthouse in Putnam County, which had cameras everywhere. He was captured by four different cameras, as far as I remember, and then went in front of the press, denied he'd had any hand in beating, choking, and stomping a helpless detainee that he outweighed by double, and wound up being charged with three crimes and settled those by retiring with a full pension and his gold shoe.
That's ridiculous. And in hearing him, I think it was a deposition you were playing on the series. Some of the questions that he did, you know, this guy is the lead detective, and I love that you played this part of it. They asked him, "Do you understand what exculpatory evidence means?" And he says, "No." And at first, I think he's being evasive, and then you listen a little more. It's like he doesn't know what it fucking means. And then they ask him about impeaching a witness, and he's like, "Impeachment, you know, like the president."
Exactly. Like, so they asked him. So impeachment evidence is really important. And yeah, this is the stuff that's taught in week two at any decent police academy, which is, number one, all defendants have Fourth Amendment rights. So you can't illegally knock down their door and search the premises. Mm-hmm. Can't go through their glove compartment or the trunk of their car if you pull them over and suspect that there's weed or there's crystal meth hiding underneath spare tire in the trunk. There's due process, right? So you need a search warrant to do that, or at least you need probable cause. The second thing they didn't teach Pat Castaldo and his partner, Bill Quick, is something called impeachment evidence. Now, what is impeachment evidence? When in the course of your investigation, you find compelling evidence that one of your witnesses is lying, you must turn that evidence over to the defense. It is a matter of settled law going back to the 60s. We're going back as far as the Miranda rights decision by the Supreme Court. So when asked if he knew what impeachment evidence was, Castaldo brightened up and said, yeah, I know that one. And Anthony's lawyer, civil lawyer, says, fine, tell us what impeachment evidence is. He goes, yeah, it's what they're trying to do to the president of the United States. So in his mind, impeachment evidence only pertained to the sitting president, Donald Trump, of the United States, and not to the two boys. Boys is what they were, who he had railroaded, coerced, extorted a false confession from one of them, and bullied, threatened, menaced his friends to testify against him. All of them recanted. Every single one of them would recant, telling jurors at Anthony's exoneration trial in 2016 that they had been treated just like those two boys. They'd been threatened with murder charges. They'd been threatened with 25 to life. In a number of cases, a gun was wielded or something equally menacing in the box. And, you know, these were unsophisticated kids, almost all of them high school dropouts, who, in fear for their lives, signed a false statement, but later recanted.
Yeah, and all those statements were written by the detectives, not by them.
Exactly right.
You're
right. There is no statement in any of the evidence presented at Anthony's three trials, at his co-defendant Andy's two trials, including his exoneration trial. By the way, let's be clear. Anthony DePippo spent 20 years in prison for the rape and murder of a girl he may have met once in passing on the street when she asked him for a cigarette. Andy had maybe met Josette once. He was bullied and tricked and menaced into signing a false confession. In both cases, well, Anthony never gave them a statement. Andy, who did 25 years, signed a 9-page confession that he never wrote, that was written out for him beforehand by this corrupt cop, Bill Quick. By the way, in the series, I run down the list of cops who colluded or had some hand in giving a hall pass to Howard Gombert, the serial predator of Putnam County.
Mm-hmm.
All of those cops are either retired with full pensions and gold shields, or they were promoted. In fact, one of them is now a sitting judge in Putnam County, adjudicating innocence and guilt when he himself was wildly guilty of grotesque police misconduct.
And in this case, the injustices go so far, because you have the injustices to Anthony and Andy, obviously, who were wrongfully convicted. I'm going to circle back to Andy because I'm curious where he sits right now. But aside from that, we learn as the series goes on, take a turn, that they are stupid. I'll give them that. But they couldn't have been so stupid they couldn't see that the person who did this was right in front of them the whole time. So you have, I just had a discussion about the Temujin Kenzu case here in Michigan. And that's one of those cases where it's like, you know, he's just a real scumbag of a human. But let's look at the facts of the case. Did he do this crime? And it brings up this like kind of moral, you know, moral dilemma. And while my guests were having that conversation, I was like, the part we're missing is, do we want to put the effort into getting this horrible person out of prison? But there's another piece to this. The person who did this to Scott Mecklem in that case is still out there if he's innocent. And that matters a lot. And in this case, it's not only do you have the two guys who are wrongfully convicted, you have this predator who continues to go on and victimize other people because he was left on the street.
So Howard Gombert had an MO. Howard Gombert at the time of Josette's abduction and killing was 33. We know a lot about Gombert's comings and goings. This is a guy who was raised by a mother we don't know the exact number of her marriages. It's at least five. And what we have learned in additional reporting post-season one about Gombert, well, a couple of things. One, his mother was sitting in the back seat of a car in the, I believe, mid-1930s, when her stepdad broke out of prison, somehow found her mother, and she stopped at a light, pulled out a revolver, blew away her mother in front of her, and left the girl in the car, a witness to the most horrific act of savagery. That girl obviously never received treatment and grew up dating and marrying a series of grotesquely violent men. And what we've learned about Howard Gombert's mother in all of this after the fact reporting is that he was raised essentially in flight from these men. The way that she would extricate herself from these horribly abusive men was by running to the next man and seeking safety and support in the arms of her next abuse. And there is a great deal we're hearing about the abuses Howard Gombert suffered as a young boy. Long story short, sometime around the age of 12, maybe 13, he breaks north and goes to live with his abusive father and his father's mother in this ramshackle quarter house in a tiny town in southern Connecticut. And by the age of 14, Gombert has either been kicked out of his own house by his father, or for his safety, has gone to live in a tent half mile into the woods, where he overwinters year after year in a lean-to through savage Northeast winters, surviving on what he kills or what he steals. So Gombert, by the time he's 15, 16, 17, is already an accomplished burglar, but he's a burglar with a twist. When he goes into people's houses, yes, he steals whatever isn't nailed down. He steals food, he steals cameras, he steals purses. He also steals the women's underwear in house after house after house. Well, this becomes very crucial evidence later on, because as we learn, Gombert has a criminal signature. So Gombert, from at least the age of 15, was already raping one 11-year-old girl we know about. She has talked to us in great, sordid, and incredibly courageous detail about her 2 years at the mercy of this monster. And you can hear some of that story in season one of The Truth, The Devil's Quarry. What we know is that by the time he meets the woman whose house becomes his base of operations, criminal operations, in the town of Carmel, he already had a criminal signature: binding, torturing, raping children. And his delivery device was the lonely, vulnerable single mothers of those girls.
Hey, Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. If you love great games and a little extra excitement to your day, I got something fun for you. Chumba Casino and I have teamed up to create an exclusive online social casino game. It's called Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's fun and free to play, just like all your favorites from Chumba Casino. And every spin brings 10,000 ways to keep the good times going. Check it out and play for free today at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So, we've got several of these girls telling us in horrific detail what this man did to them from the age of 8, from the age of 11, from the age of 7. And every law enforcement agent in Putnam County knew who Gombert was because they busted him so often for drugs, for burglaries, for moving violations. The guy was a one-man crime wave. They also knew he had been charged 1, 2, 3 times with rape by the time Josette goes missing, or shortly thereafter. So he was a known commodity to every cop in Putnam County, but one department after another gave him a pass. Even when he was the prime suspect in the disappearance of the second girl, Robin Murphy, he was never, not once, brought in and sweated in the box like those two innocent boys we've been talking about, Anthony Pippo, Andy Kriebeck. Not once. In fact, when Josette goes missing, the sheriff's office of Putnam County never so much as doorsteps him to get a line on his whereabouts on the night of October 3rd, 1994, when she goes missing in plain sight. In fact, the last time she's seen is getting into a car that is an exact duplicate, or the same car, driven by Howard Gombert, belonging to the woman he was abusing at the time, a 16-year-old, whose name I will withhold. She winds up charging him with rape right around the time Josette goes missing. By then, she's 19. She's had his baby. She's running from shelter to shelter to flee him and his violence and his rapes. And all of this was known to these cops, and they never so much as buttonholed the guy. And so we made the series to try and answer the question, why? Why was this man given a hunting license by the law enforcement community of Putnam County? We'd go a long way toward answering it, but I will leave that for the listeners to discover for themselves.
Perfect. And I will say, we end the series with you saying that you're continuing on with the second season, which will be, I assume, season 6 of Bone Valley, season 2 of The Devil's Quarry. Do we have a release date for that yet? Because I'm dying to hear the story continue.
We do. So we're doing something that, to my knowledge, has never been done before, which is bringing out season 2 within weeks of the end of season 1. We are so hungry for justice and for the pressure that we're bringing to bear on Putnam County law enforcement. There is a new regime. There is a new sheriff. Unfortunately, there is still the same corrupt DA. However, we have gone directly to the Attorney General of New York State with our evidence. We are going to the governor of New York. If we don't get the answer we need from Letitia James, New York's Attorney General, and we're doing so racing the clock, Bob. Our series has a number of things you won't hear in other true crime series. One, we get the motherfuckers. We absolutely destroy those crooked cops and crooked DAs. Two, this December, Howard Gombert, who went on to do exactly what he did in Putnam County to a 7-year-old girl in Connecticut, and to the woman who had care of her. The difference is the cops in Connecticut know what pedophilia and sexual violence against children looks like, and they take it seriously, unlike the cops in Putnam County, who didn't give a goddamn about the girls and young women in their community, didn't care a jot about them. So Gombert commits these horrific acts against this beautiful child and against her equally beautiful sort of quasi-aunt, and is immediately arrested and sentenced to 30 years for his crimes against both of them. Here's the problem. In Connecticut, 30 years turns out to be 25, which in Gombert's case may only be 24. And so this December, we fear, he will walk out of Chester Correctional Facility a free man. Not just a free man with no custodial supervision, no probation, no parole, no requirement to check in, period. He will have to register, presumably, as a sex offender. But this is a man who's lived off the grid almost since the day he could have sex. And he will disappear into a tree line. We have a pretty good sense of where that tree line is. Nonetheless, you don't have to report you're a sex offender when your neighbors are deer, foxes, screech owls, and he will reappear at a time and a place of his choosing. If I've learned anything in my 38 years of doing this work, it is that determined sexual predators cannot stop. They cannot, doesn't matter how old they are, it doesn't matter how physically active or capable they are, they live to visit violence on their object, whatever their object is. And in this case, it's preteen girls. And we have made formal outreaches, as I said, to Tish James. We're in the process of doing so now with Governor Kathy Hochul of New York. We are also going to approach senior law enforcement in Connecticut, essentially saying, what the fuck are you doing? What are you doing to protect your community? And I say this, Bob, having spent most of my 38 years getting the innocent out of prison, not keeping men in prison. But in this case, I've actually met the devil. I have met him in living flesh. I haven't met him physically. We've talked a number of times on the phone. He continues to write me. He continues to write my colleagues. Worse, he continues to write the victims of his violence. He is stalking them from prison. Imagine that. Mail going out, that's read and monitored by prison officials, is going out to this man's victims, whom he has surveilled from behind the walls. Someone is obviously tailing these women on his behalf because they've all moved and they've all, in many cases, left the state. Nonetheless, he knows where they are. And he sends them these letters you cannot believe got out of a prison. So that's the man we're talking about. I think if there's any reason we needed to continue this series and get to the bottom of the second girl's disappearance, the beautiful Robin Murphy, who disappeared again in a very public place in a ShopRite mall in Carmel, 6 months after Josette Wright disappeared. Again, who's the last person she's seen with? Seen in a car with Howard Gombert. Again, he is questioned, but never brought in, sat in the box, and grilled. Ever. This guy can't and won't stop. And we are fighting the clock and the calendar and urging our many, many hundreds of thousands, and by now over a million listeners, to speak with us, to stand with us, to write to the governor of New York, to write to the district attorney, of the attorney general of New York, and say, help, please, just do your job. Just do your job, which is to protect the most vulnerable people in your community from the predations of a man like Howard Gunn.
Well, you've done amazing work in season one. I can't wait for season two. Can we have the date for season two, or is that set in stone yet?
We are, I believe, September 30th.
Okay.
That may change, but we are gunning for the end of September. The rollout will be a little different. We'll be dropping an episode a week. I'm not sure you'll be able to bundle season two, but the last episode will revolve around me standing outside the prison gates waiting for Gombert to walk out.
That's incredible. So that is coming up in less than 2 months. In the meantime, make sure you check out season five of Bone Valley, The Devil's Quarry. Paul, your reporting is incredible. The podcast was great. I love the work you're doing. Keep it up. And thanks again for taking the time to talk to me today.
Again, it's a privilege. It's an honor. And, you know, having fellow travelers like you to communicate this insane public safety threat to, and for your listeners to engage with this grotesque injustice. I will tell your listeners, you may think you're going to dial in for 5-10 minutes. Just see if any of what you actually hear lives up to Bob's hype. I dare you to stop listening. I dare you not to binge the entire season in one sitting. It's that compelling, twisty. It's a novel I could never have written, because who's capable of this?
Right.
And yet, it not only happened, we have court-tested evidence that horrific injustices occurred and are still unadjudicated. And that must stop. So thank you for a place to dump my outrage and my, you know, my urgent plea to your listeners. Join with us. Make all our voices heard, because the collective is so much stronger than, you know, the single voice in the wilderness. So thank you.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kay Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found @BobRuffTruth. Janet can be found @JanetVarney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.